We want to continue this morning in our series in the book of Ecclesiastes. So I would encourage you to open up your Bibles, open up your iPads, open up your phones, whatever it might be. We're going to look at two passages of Scripture this morning. First is going to be Ecclesiastes chapter 2, 18 to 23, and then we'll be looking at chapter 4, 13 through 16. So we started off the whole series with an introduction, and then we talked about some facts of life, that there are certain things that are uncertain in this life, there are certain things like time and death are inevitable, and then we moved on from there to some of the different things that are meaningless. And today we want to focus upon this subject of the meaninglessness of sweat and status. And to what we're going to be talking about really is talking about work. We're going to be talking about work, and we're going to be talking about position. We're going to be talking about prominence. We're going to be talking about some of the things that are involved every day in the lives of every single person for the most part. As I reflected upon this, I was thinking about some of my life, and I was thinking about some of the things that I've done. And you know, sometimes you look back and you go, wow, you know what? That's a bit embarrassing that I thought that way or I acted that way. And I hope that I've matured a little bit. There was areas in my life in terms of work and of status that, to be truthful, were embarrassing. I was a young youth pastor, probably about 24, 25, and I got it into my head that I wanted to have the biggest ministry. I had stars in my eyes about the fact of having hundreds of kids flocking to what we were doing, and I dreamt of being that guy that went to conferences and spoke and wrote curriculum and books, and everyone wanted to use them, everyone wanted to read them. I even worked on some curriculum. I even sent it off to a publisher. I even have started to write a book. I'm about halfway through it. I haven't picked it up in a long time, in years actually, but it's sitting there. I had wanted my work to be known in my field. So all the big names, all of that, I wanted to be part of that. I wanted the success that they had. And I took on a very kind of pragmatic approach. Outside of doing things that would be wrong or immoral, I would try anything. I would try anything that would get people to come. We took a building like this and covered the whole floor in plastic and ran it up the walls and filled the whole place with this slime. And we had giant slip and slides. Hundreds of kids coming out, all kinds of things. It was crazy, some of the stuff we were doing. And one person might have said, well, he's doing it because he really cares for the kids and he wants many to come out, and because we would share the gospel that night and all this stuff. And that was true. But there was also that part of me that wanted the bigger and the better and to be known. So I would try most anything if it would increase these things. I took on a position as a youth pastor in Southern California. Southern California is mostly regarded as the mecca of youth ministry. If you want to make it big, that's where you go. You and the movie stars. That's all that's there. You want to achieve great things. Now, I'm telling you things that I would probably not have admitted for a long time to a number of people. I didn't even admit it to myself. And you don't know what happened of all that ambition and all that dreams and all that things that I wanted to have happen, to the point where I had almost burned myself out. In fact, I think I did burn myself out, I just didn't admit it, and I kept going. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. God, in His graciousness, never let any of it happen. It was a graciousness. I don't even know what happened to the curriculum I wrote. I have really little ambition to finish the book, except maybe for myself, not to necessarily get published. And I doubt that in California anyone remembers me. In fact, some people maybe are choosing not to remember me. I don't know. So why did I break my back planning events to bring all these kids out? Why did I spend sleepless nights trying to come up with the next best thing? Why did I try to do that? Why did I do that when all of this really amounts to meaninglessness? See, Solomon had the same reflection. He did all this amazing work. He built a great kingdom. He was famous, truly famous. Other rulers would come from other nations to check him out, to see what he was doing, to be awestruck in his presence. And in the end, he concludes, it's all vanity of vanities. It is all pointless. So, What does he have to say about this as we look at work and we look at status? To chapter 2, 18 to 23, he tells us, there is no meaning in our work. He says this, I hate it, all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is a vanity. So he talks about what work is. And we sometimes want to know, well, how do we define work? And so I looked it up in the dictionary, and it basically says, what work is physical or mental effort directed toward the production or accomplishment of something. So it's mental or physical effort directed toward the production and accomplishment of something. So in other words, this is what work is. If I have to get up and walk to the TV to change the channel because I can't find the remote, that is work. If I go out and say to my wife, we're going to go on a date, and I go and I plan it, and I buy flowers, and I make arrangements and do all those sort of things, she's not going to be very impressed when I say to her, I hope this is all worth it because it was a lot of work. We would rarely, if ever, consider playing a sport work, but it would qualify as physical or mental effort. Maybe it's better to say this, that work is something we must do when we would rather be doing something else. Maybe that's how you define it. I'm not quite sure. Now, maybe the bigger question we have is, why do we work? Now, it maybe seems obvious to earn money. To earn money in order to buy things like food and clothing and transportation and shelter. Pay our heating bill this time of year. It's a good idea. But what drives us often to achieve more in work is a combination of wanting to earn more and have greater status or power so we can buy what we want, not necessarily what we need. Society works for their toys, for their dreams, for their leisure. And ultimately, we work so we don't have to work. Work can be something we take for granted. We assume that everyone is expected to do that, that everyone wants to do that. It's kind of, in some circles, not even questioned. And in one sense, the Bible completely confirms this. In 2 Thessalonians 3:10, it says, if anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. Presumed that you will. It's part of the normal, almost a necessary evil in the course of life. Now, obviously, it is important. And the more things you want, the more important it becomes, either to earn what you want to get or pay off what you could not wait to earn. If how we spend our time is any indication of the value of our work and how we consider it, it is very important because, on average, we spend more time working than we do sleeping. We spend a lot of mental energy on our work. Much of our education, even as younger people, is designed to help us to get a job. Certainly that is true of those who are going to university. You're not going to university just for fun and to spend money willy-nilly. You're doing it because you're hoping a job would come at the end of it. So we make our plans for our work. We even worry about what our work will be. But it even goes deeper than that. Both men and women can make work an issue of value. Now, men and women are going to approach this differently, with distinctions. But overall, people look to their work often to find identity, who they are, How many times have you had a conversation with someone that you never knew, and one of the first things you ask is, what do you do? And talk about their work. In fact, you can sometimes say to someone, who are you? And they'll say, they designate themselves according to their occupation. We can find our worth in what we do, in what we work at. We can find it very gratifying to find that. And we also find our happiness. We work for this to the point that we might even be called and labeled workaholics. Now, how does Koheleth look at work? As you would guess, as we have read, he has some pretty negative things to say. But he says this. For a moment, if this would be Solomon speaking, he might say something like this. Put God out of your mind, just for a moment, and take a close look at your work, at your job. And tell me, what good is it? He says, from the view under the sun, all of it is meaningless. It's like the lyrics of the song called 5 o'clock World, which says, up every morning just to keep a job, I gotta fight my way through the hustling mob, sounds of the city pounding in my brain while another day goes down the drain. That's how it can feel like. So why do we do all this work? And why is it meaningless? Why does he say that? Well, when we look at verse 18, we see firstly, he says all of our work will be left behind when we die. The preacher goes as far as to say that he hates his work because all the effort that it takes and consumes us, we can't even take it with us. We get a job, we work our way up the ladder, we contribute to our field of study or whatever we do, and at the end, they will give you your last paycheck. Maybe they bake you a cake and they send you on your way. Then in retirement, all that work is just memory of the time in which your life actually mattered. Then someone younger, better looking, comes along, more competent perhaps, takes over your job, and you will be remembered for as long as it takes to get your name off the door and put his or her name on it. That's what he says. You can't take it with you. You can leave it all behind. What's the point? Then he says in verse 19, another reason why it's meaningless is we work hard and others will become the masters over the outcome of what we have done. You are gone. And someone else will take over what you have been doing. Maybe something that you've even created and founded. And he or she will own what you have done. They'll put their name on it. They may even claim it to be their own. Or they might dismantle it altogether. So you work hard. You build something up. Only for the next person, without regard, without sensitivity, they will slash and burn your baby. So what use is there in giving the better part of your life to only give it to someone who doesn't deserve it? And so he says it's meaningless. Then in verse 20 to 21, he gives us another reason why it's meaningless. He says our work is a source of despair because others will enjoy what we hoped to enjoy for ourselves. If we look at it as the preacher has, we should probably just all give up. Why bother trying? What is the point of it all? Going to work becomes like volunteering to die. It's just a horrible thing. And remember all that Solomon has done. He has built houses and gardens and vineyards. He supervised huge workforces. He built a kingdom. He accumulated all kinds of fortune. He was an excellent administrator and an excellent business person. And when he died, everything went to his eldest son, Rehoboam, who foolishly lost 80% of all of his father's kingdom. In our day, it could be like a family who built a business. And when it was time to hand it down to the next generation, they just took it, divided it all up, and sold it off. What was the point of all of that? Or maybe it's like this. There's a person, and they plant a grove of peach trees from little seedlings. And they take care of those peach trees, and they nurture those peach trees, and they prune them, and they care for them. All to get to the point where one day they will pick a ripe peach off one of those peach trees and bite into it, and the juice will dribble down their chin, and it will just be a wonderful, wonderful thing. But in the process, the person gets sick. The person dies. But before he or she does, he instructs others of how to take care of the peach tree and how to look after it. But the man is barely in the ground, barely dead, and the first crop of peaches is ready. And those that came after him, they celebrate how clever they are at growing peaches as the juice drips down their chin. That's what life can be like. We work hard and hard and hard and never enjoy any of it because we give it off to someone else because we don't get to have it. Another reason he gives us is in verse 22 to 23. He says that we can burn out for our work and we find no rest and no happiness. Solomon describes a life where a person pours his heart out for all that he does. Maybe he even really enjoys it, really believes he is doing something important. But his work turns into toil. It turns into pressure. And it becomes something that he dreads to do. He begins to hate his work. The work is sorrow and dread, and he even can't even sleep at night because of it. If you consider that you cannot take it with you, if you consider that you have to leave it to someone else, if you consider that you will not even get to enjoy the outcome of your labor, there's really no reason not to hate it. Now, I've had jobs where every day when the alarm goes off in the morning and you hear that dreaded sound, you say, I can do this. I can do this. It's just one more day. It's one more day. We maybe have all had kind of jobs like that. I remember working in a sewing factory. And that was like terrible. It was awful. And it just every day, I can do this, I can do this. One more day. I've also seen the frustration in my work as a pastor. To be truthful, I've worked at hopefully under God's direction, building up a ministry and caring for people. I genuinely want to do so. And then someone else took my place and they changed everything up. They changed everything we'd ever worked for. It was all different now than it was before. And they even saw fruit from the things that I had planted. Working in people's lives, and I got nowhere with them, and they come along, and the person all of a sudden makes all kinds of changes. And you go, what in the world? It can feel despairing if you don't have the right attitude. A view from under the sun says, why do I even bother trying? In several weeks, we are going to study what it is or how do we live in the midst of the meaninglessness of life. We're going to look at what it means to live in this perspective when it comes to our work. So I won't say much more here on that today, but let me say this. Consider your work carefully. Why do you do it? Have you ever asked yourself that question? Why do I do what I do? And what place, what prominence, what perspective do we have on our work? Are you treating your work or career as your identity? Is it who you are? Is it your self-worth? Is it your hope, your dreams, your ambitions? How much value are you giving it in your life? You may really enjoy your work, but should it consume us? I have been there. I've been so enamored with my work that I remember when Beriah was born, I hardly could even take a moment off to be there for Christine through it because I was too focused on my work. And it doesn't help, does it, that the view of work that is in this world is celebrated. That if you are an overachiever, if you work really hard, if someone comes up to you and say, you know what, that person works harder than anyone I know, we take that as a compliment. We proudly wear the label of workaholic. We have industries that set ideals that no one can sustain over the long term. And they try to motivate the minions by dangling the carrot of success in front of them. Now, we can work to buy that car or a home or a recreational desire, and what is going to happen to all of that for all the work that we do? Someone else is going to drive that car, and when we no longer own it or need it, they're going to take it, and they're not going to treat it like you did. They're going to fill the whole back seat with fast food wrappers. Someone will move into the home that you may have lived in, and they're going to neglect it, or they might take a wall that you built and tear it down because they don't care. We're going to work for that savings, and we will pass away, and someone else will take everything we earned, and they'll just drink beer and buy lottery tickets. That's what it amounts to. So according to this, so our work is nothing but a vexation, a vanity, and a sorrow under the sun. And we'll leave it there. And we'll pick it up at another time. But I would draw you ahead to chapter 4, verses 13 to 16. Because here he talks about the fact that there is no meaning in our position, or as we put it here, in our status, in chapter 4, 13 to 16. He says this, "Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and a striving after wind." The preacher here, Koheleth, Solomon, is providing us a scene of how there is meaninglessness in status, in our position, in our power. He contrasts a poor and a wise youth with an old and foolish king. It's a bit of a role reversal here. And the king is deemed foolish because he will not take advice. And in verse 14, it describes a kind of rags-to-riches story of how a poor and wise youth rises to take and usurp the position of this old and foolish king. Biblically, it might remind you of someone like David, who was a young shepherd, and God raises him up to take Saul's place as king. And David, for the most part, seemed to be more wise than Saul. Saul did a lot of foolish things and didn't take advice. He didn't have the ability to do that, and he was replaced. The younger man rose in promises and prominence and led countless people. But even then, as he describes it here, his status was unstable. Solomon presents this as one, as a person. He had the experience. He was a person who held great fame. He had great power. He had exceptional status in society. There was really no one who would be above him at that time. But through his observations, he states that a person can be at the top of the mountain and can be replaced. And the person that takes his place will also be replaced. So he certainly experienced this as he came to the end of his life when Jeroboam tried to rise up against him. But even though he overcame that opposition, Solomon was replaced. He ruled in Jerusalem for 40 years, and then his son Rehoboam took his place. And you know what? For the most part in our world, they're both forgotten. They're not remembered. Solomon says that being powerful and famous is meaningless. So why do so many people so often desire some form of it in their lives? Well, one reason is that being recognized can be wrongly understood as being loved and appreciated. How many stars, you know, have people, flocks of people coming, "Oh, we love you, we love you, we love you." They don't even know each other. And they're expressing this kind of thing, and it feels so good. "Oh, I'm adored and loved and appreciated." But it's really just false. Another reason is that status can be pursued for its power. Now, you can hold a high position such as a prime minister. And imagine that. You have the ability to shape the lives of millions of people. That can be incredibly intoxicating. Or it can be maybe a more of a of an unofficial kind of status that gains public admiration and gives the person special treatment, you know, such as a movie star. I remember we took our family to Disney World in Orlando, and we wanted to go on a ride, and we were delayed by about an hour because some celebrity was there with her kids, and they shut down the entire ride so she could ride it with her kids by herself. It was crazy. She had that status. How good she might have felt that I can command an entire amusement park. Fame can provide an economic windfall is another reason why people do it. A person can be a famous actor. I've seen this before. They are maybe a really good actor. And then they decide, they get it in their heads, I'm going to write a book. And they write a book. And you know what? If it was written by anyone else than someone who is famous, who the publisher thought that they could make money off of them because their name had notoriety, no one would ever publish it. But they get it published. They have that kind of power. They can do those kind of things. And high status also provides influence. People can admire someone else. They want to emulate them. They want to buy what they are endorsing. They enjoy the fact that someone wants to walk like them and talk like them and dress like them and do their hair like them. They're excited about that. Now, does everyone want to be revered by millions? No, I suppose some do. They want their star on the Walk of Fame. They want to have a Twitter account ever. They want to be written about in history books. And sometimes you can tell that's what they're aiming for because of the way in which they are trying to self-promote themselves. Others, maybe not so much. We don't want that. Maybe we just want to be known as a good teacher or a great teacher. Maybe we want to be, just in our small little world here, we just want to be a winning coach. Maybe all we really want is just to have my kids think highly of me. Maybe that's all we really want. Much of the world is displaying its feathers like a peacock because reverence and appreciation and status is intoxicating. To have it is to be able to have your way, to be selfish, to be a jerk, and everyone will still want to be you. I was reading about this week where I was looking at these documents that celebrities attach to contracts. So they're gonna act in a movie, they're going to do a performance, they're going to sing, and they say, these are the things that I require for me to come and do this. So one person said, I will not come and perform unless you put a cheetah print rug in my dressing room. Another person said, well, I don't like to be deal with colors, so I want everything in my dressing room to be white. White tables, white flowers, white couch, white rugs, white walls. Everything's got to be white draperies. Everything's got to be white. Another person said, well, I will be more than glad than to come and sing or act in your production if you get me a three-wheeled electric scooter. Had nothing to do with the movie, but he just wanted a three-wheeled electric scooter. Or the person that says, I'll come and perform if you make sure that in my dressing room there are bendy straws. Yeah, we can't even get straws now, but they can demand bendy straws. That's the things you can do. You're a jerk and an idiot. And people are but you're still loved by people? It's crazy. So the preacher criticizes the notion of trying to build a position for ourselves. He explains to us, if we are ever tempted to pursue notoriety, that it is a meaningless pursuit. And this is why. Verse 13. It's because we're all replaceable. He tells us, as he explains, that a youth is taking the position of an established king, that there is no job security. Even kings and dictators are expendable. The person who is the most famous actress is going to get old and wrinkly and be replaced by someone younger and prettier. You could rise to be the coach of an NHL team. You could be the CEO of a major company. You could be the president of a country. And you'll be replaced. You could lose your job. You could be impeached. A lot of things could happen. Why would someone work so hard, Solomon is lamenting, to achieve something that can be so easily taken away? Another reason he gives is in verse 14. He says the norms of society are no guarantee of keeping our position. He talks about how there is a king, and he comes from royalty. And if you come from royalty, then it means that your successor is going to come from royalty, and it's a successive plan. But here we have an idea where a notion where there is a person who is poor, does not come from wealth, does not come from fame, doesn't come, and rises above the person that was of royalty. It shouldn't happen. And we see this kind of trend, and we believe it, that you could be an actor, and more than likely your kids are going to get opportunities to be an actor because you are one. People born with wealth have a greater chance of fame. But Solomon says this is all just false assurance. Even a poor person may take the place of a royal. Another reason, verse 15 and 16. We can command many people, yet it does not ensure that we will be appreciated. He tells us that a person can have a high status, that they can literally lead an endless number of people, and yet it says they don't rejoice over him. And what this can mean is that you could be the president of the U.S. of A, lead 300 million people, command one of the biggest militaries in the world. You could have the keys to nuclear weapons. Be voted into office by a winning majority. You can accomplish or try to accomplish everything that you have ever said you would do in your campaign. And when the approval ratings come out, you're at 29%, 25%, 30%. Most people don't want you. In a small way, I've experienced a little bit of this. As a pastor, I've come to a church, and I think of this in one context, and it's a little embarrassing in a way to express it, but I had people come up to me and say, wow, it's good to have you. You're so good at this and good at that and all those things. And even had someone else go up to someone from my church at that time and say, where did you find him? And all these different things. And you know what? Months later, those exact same people are telling me how horrible I am and are trying to get me fired. It's the reality. People who are on top of the world based on the admiration of others can be blown off by the fickle winds of opinion. A person may have been famous and can be quickly be infamous. And then in verse 16, he takes the same idea and puts a little different turn on it. And he tells us that it's meaningless because those with status are going to be forgotten. It says that those who come later will not rejoice in him. It's speaking about a person that maybe have been famous and had great status and then is remembered no more. Now, this can be done passively, where you're really not intending to forget them. You know, one person rises after the other person kind of fades away, and we don't even think about them. You know, all of a sudden, maybe someone brings it up. Well, where is so-and-so? Whatever happened to them? We don't know, no one remembers. And then we sometimes intentionally try to forget people. We want to rewrite history. We want to change things. We've seen this with the whole phenomenon of trying to take down monuments and things like that. So, and some of it we understand. We go, do we really want to remember Hitler and Lenin and Saddam Hussein? Really, do we want to remember them? They were brutal, horrible people. They deserve to be forgotten. And then there's others. They want to take down monuments of Christopher Columbus and John A. MacDonald. There's even a suggestion that they blow up Mount Rushmore. Because we just want to forget that time in our lives and just pretend it never happened. We want to erase history. So in other words, a person can live their entire life with the aim to be famous. Imagine the guy that spent all that time carving out and chipping away at Mount Rushmore, and now they just want to blow it up. Less than a generation later, you can be completely forgotten or ignored. You're not even a footnote in a history book. So what is the connection here between work and holding status? Well, they are both places that people are looking to for success. They're looking for success. To one degree or another, every person wants to be successful in life. No one wants to be a failure. No one's asking to do that. And this may include their work. And to be recognized by others or having some kind of position of power. Why do people chase after something that Solomon rightly says is meaninglessness. It will not last. It cannot. It's because we have been fed a line. We have been fed a bill of goods. We have been told what is right. And we've been deceived. We've been told what success is. And therefore, in that same vein, we've been told what will make us happy. Robert Louis Stevenson said, "The man is a success who has lived well, laughed often, loved much, who has gained the respect of intelligent men and the love of children, who has filled his niche and accomplished his task, who leaves the world better than he found it, whether by an improved poppy, a perfect poem, or a rescued soul, who never lacked appreciation of earthly beauty or failed to express it, who looked for the best in others and gave the best he had." Now, I'm going to conclude, based on what the Bible says and what Solomon says, is that his version of success is incredibly short-sighted. These are all things that Solomon says are meaningless. Life, love, laughter, respect, even giving our so-called best is going to be eclipsed by others. We are going to be forgotten. Others will love better. They will live better. They'll be respected more. They'll laugh harder. This is not success. We are going to have, all of us are going to have our own idea, our own version of success. When we talk about work, when we talk about status, these are just two of them that we've looked at today. Looking for meaning in these things, we are looking in a direction that is opposite of what God intends for our lives. Should you work hard at your job? Should you grow your business? Should you advance in your field? I would say certainly, sure. But that should not be your measure of success. That really is reaching for a kind of mediocrity. Is it wrong to be known or to have power or to have influence over many people? No, not particularly. But this should not be our measure of success. It's another form of mediocrity. The only person that is remembered and is attributed with success is the one whose accomplishments have lasted. No one remembers all the people that tried to build an automobile. They remember Henry Ford, put it one way. And what is lasting success? What does it mean to have a success that goes well beyond your time, well beyond our lives? Because in this world, in our lives as people, all that we have done and all that we are is going to be forgotten. Success is meaningless under the sun in our work and status because it's all going to pass away. What is going to last is what is eternal. Now, what can we spend our days on that will not rust or decay or be destroyed? Now, we're going to look at this more, but I'll say this for now. It is not being bigger than Apple or Microsoft. It is not making more money than the person who gets to have the corner office. It is not inventing the next big thing that will change millions of lives. It is not even getting a raise. It is not moving from being cook to night shift manager. It is not hiring another staff. It is not getting a gold watch for 25 years of service. It is not being more famous than a Kardashian. It is not being more famous than Chris Hemsworth. And if you don't know who that is, then that's fine. It is not having more power than a world leader. It is not having your own TV show or vlog or the most downloaded app on the Apple Store. It is not even making the honor roll. It is not even winning an election to be school trustee. It is not even getting your name in the paper. It's not even having your kids saying that you're a great mom or dad. It's not any of those things. Not any of those things. That is not what success is. It is more than that. Much, much more. And I'm going to leave it right there. Now let's think about that. Let's pray.